Motoring journalism will die. Everyone hates car journalists and it's killing us. Car magazines and comic books. I have no recollection of when it might have been, but I'm pretty sure I started reading both voraciously as soon as I could, well, read. Motor magazine, later Autocar and Motor, plus Car magazine, where I became an LJK Setright fan, who I later actually got to meet, and the Performance Car, where I first became aware of Jeremy Clarkson. This was before he became a Top Gear presenter. I was buying car magazines right up to the noughties. These days, though, I will rarely pick up a periodical. I stopped buying them because I realized I'd stopped reading them. They would just stack up on my side table until they toppled over. Admittedly, comic book purchases ceased even earlier, during the 90s, probably around the time that superhero movies got good again. There was about 10 years between Christopher Reeve's standard-bearing Superman the movie and Batman 1989, still two of the best superhero movies ever, I maintain. But today, with so many great superhero movies and great TV shows and so much content, why do you need to buy a comic book anymore? With all due respect to those people who still do, of course. Right there, then, you're beginning to see a parallel as to how my two main reading compulsions started to recede. The advent of good motoring websites, remember World Car Fans and when Autoblog and Jalopnik first became popular, plus online video content through YouTube. Essentially, this stuff seduced and satiated me quicker and more comprehensively than mere magazines could do. But there's more to it than that. While physical publications are on the verge of extinction, where, to be fair, they've been teetering for about a decade now, it's the notion of actual automotive journalism itself that is ultimately on life support and, in my opinion, about to be pronounced brain dead with the plug unceremoniously to be pulled. Everyone hates us. Motoring journalists, that is. Well, okay, maybe hate is a strong word, but audiences think that we don't know what we're talking about, and car manufacturers don't like us knowing what we're talking about. To be fair, though, car journalists have, frankly, always been a bit out of touch with actual car buyers. Ask motorists what they look for in a car, and they'll give you a list of thoughtful parameters, such as suitability for purpose, efficiency, safety, reliability, etc. However, delve deeper into the psyche of a car buyer, strip away all the logical BS, and you realize that actually, cars are either an emotional purchase or a necessary one. The latter buyers don't care what motoring journalists think. They just buy what they need, when they need it, for the money that they can afford, usually based on the proximity of the seller, sometimes with advice from friends and family, these days maybe a quick glance at online ratings, or they might just even stick with the brand and the model that they've always bought. Meanwhile, the former people, the emotional ones, they also don't care what motoring journalists think because they've already made up their mind about what they want. And if we dare to tell them that it might in some way not be the most suitable, appropriate, or sensible purchase based on their requirements and circumstances, they'll simply dismiss us and continue until they find a verdict that does corroborate the choice that they've already made. As for motoring journalists themselves, the vast majority start out because they love cars. Unfortunately, somewhere along the way, they usually forget that. They lose sight of having started down this route because they found cars fun. Instead, they get very po-faced and snobbish, cliquey, overly serious, frankly a bit up themselves, and totally disconnected from their actual audiences. Guys, we're not reporting on wars or crime or politics here. It's just cars. At some point, car journalists stop writing for readers and start writing for each other. The cliches, the engineering and design terminology that no one understands, the knowing in-jokes and jives, and the fact that they test every single car 10 tenths or sideways on a racetrack proves that whatever it is that they're doing, it's merely for their own pleasure, to impress their contemporaries with their self-perceived brilliance, or to annoy manufacturers. Or in the case of digital content, it's simply aimed at getting more views. And there's one other thing that somehow they have not quite come to accept. And that is that for the last 20 years, and even the last 15 years in the case of Chinese cars, cars have got good, very good. As an automotive reviewer, it used to be possible to easily identify clearly competent cars and blatantly bad ones. Cheapness and shortcuts would be very evident to our eyes, and brilliance would shine through. Take, for example, the first generation Kia Rio that I reviewed back in 1999. It handled and gripped so badly in the wet, and the windscreen wipers were so abysmal that one particularly wet day, I was seriously thinking of calling my wife and telling her that I loved her because I wasn't sure that I was going to make it back. On the other hand, a 1998 Ford Focus hatchback was an absolute revelation in not just its practicality, but also the ride, handling, and steering dynamics. But just a few years later, of course, every manufacturer had learned how to make good cars. I mean, let's go back to Kia. I'd happily recommend any modern Kia from within the last 20 years, and the latest ones are absolutely outstanding. All manufacturers now know how to make cars properly, engineer them for robustness, and set them up to drive superbly, and then the computers can figure out the rest. They're also perfectly attuned to what 99.9% of owners will actually use them for, and I don't mean perceived use. I mean actual use. For example, a sports car is rarely ever driven on track, and an off-roader almost never leaves the tarmac. There's presently so much data and research on drivers, driving behavior, driver demographics, and how motorists use cars that manufacturers frankly know how to precisely fine-tune their offerings. And having spent billions doing so, they really don't like to be judged by amateur engineers masquerading as motoring journalists. Which brings us to the modern phenomenon of influencers, and in particular, car influencers. Social media influencers are just having a great time. They're sharing that with their followers, and when they drive new cars, they're like kids in a sweet shop. They're just happy to be there, and everything simply tastes yummy. And frankly, the audiences relate to that, and the key thing with them is that they've remembered what we've forgotten, is that they're doing this because they love cars. Unfortunately, between all the selfies and the beauty shots of the car, there's maybe not the time, space, and possibly even the ability to give any independent analysis, which of course suits car makers just fine. Deal with motoring journalists and you just never know what they might say about your product. Let influencers loose with it and they ooh and ah and get you loads of views on their posts, not many of which will actually influence buyers and translate into actually sales, but apparently that's no longer relevant. It is very apparent, however, that several manufacturers, for some years now, have pivoted to snubbing journos altogether and entertaining social media influencers instead. And frankly, it's easy to see why. I mean, fair play to the influencers. They're a happy bunch, and happiness is better than hate in a world overwhelmingly dominated by that these days. Everybody hates cars. And sadly, hate in the world has extended to the automobile. In the 20th century, humanity fell completely in love with the automobile. The advent of the automotive age did so much for us, from freedom of movement, the ability and ease of getting around, to traveling and having adventures, to creating a focus for our passion and interests. From weekends spent racing or washing our cars, to hours spent drooling over motors that we could never afford, cars definitely kept us engaged for decades. Unfortunately, at this point in the 21st century, improved public transport systems and rides on demand at the end of an app have caused the smartphone generation to be the least interested generation in cars and driving than any before them. Having all their friends and any kind of delivery service all just a tap away on their phone means they just don't need to get around so much. Then there's a highly effective, and as a car fan, I would say damaging, anti-car propaganda that has got people believing that cars are actually somehow evil. Also, that if we just did away with cars, our world would be saturated with colorful daisies and pink fluffy unicorns. The car is being singled out and blamed for everything from the hole in the ozone layer to your granny dying of old age. We're getting ultra-low emission zones, 15-minute cities, and low-traffic neighborhoods, which are LTNs, as punishment for our previously enduring adulation of the automobile. There is no denying that there is an environmental impact and consequence of making and motoring in personal cars. More on that in a minute. But the big black carbon footprint of humanity on Mother Earth is from a cumulative impact of all of our machinations and man-made miracles, not to mention our conflicts. The war in Ukraine, for example, alone has put out at least 33 million tons of greenhouse gases, it is estimated. And, you know, there's military action going on all over the world at any given point in time. The world's military sector is known to generate around 6% of all CO2 emissions. And then there's the rebuilding that has to be done after you've blown a country to bits. Post-war reconstruction can cause as much as 22 million tons of CO2 emissions. Buildings, you know, the things that we inhabit, they're accountable for 39% of global carbon emissions, mostly from operational emissions. So that's heating, cooling, cooking, entertainment, and waste. 11% of that 39 is just from construction and materials that are needed to make them. So should we just all go back to living in mud huts? Don't think so. And then you have shipping. The nitrogen dioxide emissions of the world maritime fleet are higher than all of the cars in the world put together. Plus, shipping also produces more sulfur than cars. And then there's aviation, which is responsible for around 2.1% of human-induced CO2 emissions. Transport admittedly accounts for around 30% of global emissions, in fact. And yes, 72% of that 30%, that is from road transport, which includes cars, vans, buses, lorries, motorbikes, etc. However, we need road transport, we need buildings to live in, and, well, we don't need wars. Plus, the latest cars in particular are cleaner and more efficient than ever. Compare the technological solutions to reducing the carbon footprint and emissions that are being developed and deployed in the automotive industry to, say, the aviation and shipping industries. They appear positively archaic. Regardless, I emphasize again, we need transportation, ultimately. Not just to get around, but for all the stuff that we want. From the food that we eat to the smartphones that we seem to love so much. The car is not evil, but it's an easy target. For a younger generation that don't see the necessity or the appeal of owning and driving one, and with such high ownership costs these days, you can't really blame them, it's easy to believe all the negative propaganda. Pulling this all back to the original discussion at hand, and what this means is that they have no use for motoring journalists, commentators, and eventually even influencers. Everyone hates pain. As already inferred, the high cost of learning to drive and then owning, insuring, and running a car is a massive put-off. However, what I'm referring to here is that everyone hates paying us. Us, the motoring journalists and content creators. Motoring magazines, for example, the staffs have been dramatically downsized. Newspapers just buy in generic content or reprint press releases rather than actually employ a motoring correspondent on staff. And the freelance rates are rubbish, and there's little or no additional value placed on experience, unless your name is Jeremy Clarkson, of course. It's not entirely the publisher's fault either. Audiences don't want to pay for printed periodicals or digital paywalls when there's so much free content available online. This, of course, makes it then harder for publishers to afford original expert content. The lack of real revenue has actually killed off some astonishing digital age giants in the automotive media world already. I mean, who remembers the pioneers of beautiful visual automotive porn that was Petrolicious? Okay, it's been relaunched, but it's not what it was. Nor is DriveTribe, started by no less than the aforementioned Clarkson & Co. Carfection died recently, and Chris Harris tried numerous digital ventures before giving up and jumping on board with Top Gear. And MotorTrend and its Accent channels decided that they needed to go behind a paywall. What's the common factor with all of these failures? Well, big epic videos and high production values. Time and again, I see automotive content creators trying to produce Top Gear for YouTube, and I immediately know that they will eventually fail, except in a specific scenario that I'll come back to. Take, for example, the cost of producing a car review for TV. You're talking about a presenter, producer, director, cameraman or two, soundman, runners, and then an editor, maybe a day or more's production, potentially the same again for editing. I mean, it's hard to put an exact cost on it, but I'd estimate easily around £8,000 to £10,000. TV production might be able to justify that, but not digital media. Of course, you could cut that down a fair bit with a smaller team, but factor in the cost of still going to a location and staying there, you're probably still looking at £2,000 to £3,000. Add in maybe the rental of a track or an airfield if you're looking to be doing sideways shenanigans like on the telly, and you could be up to £4,000 to £5,000. And I haven't even factored in the cost of the equipment itself, which, if you buy decent stuff, could be several thousand pounds alone. Now, if you're fortunate enough to get millions of views, you might recoup some of that cost in terms of YouTube earnings, but it'll be a miracle if you make a profit. Depending on where your video is being viewed and by whom, for example, American viewers are usually the most profitable, most videos, even with views in the hundreds of thousands, will barely make a few hundred pounds. In my case, for example, that's my entire channel. That's why I'm still a freelancing journalist. Without those other gigs, I would not be able to make ends meet, and even my humble little channel would have to close. This is why things like Patreon and Ko-fi are vital to help smaller creators like me keep going. Frankly, making high-quality YouTube videos for a living is simply not viable unless you're one of the massive players in the field like MrBeast, etc. This is why even automotive YouTube channels with millions of subscribers will fail. They can't afford to sustain the level of content that gets them to those millions of followers in the first place. It only works in two cases. If the channel is complementary to a larger, more profitable business, such as in the case of CarWow or Haggerty, for example. Essentially, there it's a marketing exercise for the main business, which might be selling cars or motor insurance. And frankly, thank goodness for such arrangements, because it gives us that high quality of content for free on channels that we can all access. The other case is if it's a fun vanity project for people with too much time and money on their hands, which is also absolutely fine, by the way, and potentially gives us irreverent and real-world content that we wouldn't normally get, such as an owner smashing up his own supercar in front of a dealer because he wasn't happy with the service. For the rest of us automotive content creators, it's a struggle, one that we manage only by pretty much being a one-man band and keeping as tight with spending as possible and constantly trying to work out how to maximize views with minimum expense. But it's a struggle that we persist with, mainly because we want to provide you with information, we want to entertain you, we want to help and guide you, and we have something to say that we firmly believe is of value, and because we're compelled to do it, whether you want us to or not. However, we live a little in fear of the future because we know that the clock is ticking, and that's no way to function, frankly. So if I do disappear one day, don't be surprised. Just be sad. Brown car guy. Hope you enjoyed that video. If you did, please, please hit the like button and share this video as well if you can. And while you're at it, check out these guys who also sponsor my content. I am deeply grateful to them because it helps me to buy new equipment, put fuel in the cars, and yes, buy a cup of coffee. You can do the same, just go here, or right here on YouTube, just hit these three little dots down here and click on thanks. Make sure you're signed in first. My content is free, but this is how you can help me keep it that way. I may even send you a gift. Oh, by the way, watch this next.